be here with you today. There's a principle in business that no sale is ever made until there is first established a need or a problem or a desire on the part of somebody. After one of those three things happens in any individual, including ourselves, then a purchase will be made. If you go into a store, you don't go there unless you have a need or a desire or a problem to be solved by something that the merchant has to sell. The easiest type of sale to make is the sale that gives the quickest satisfaction to the purchaser. For example, food. Everybody buys food very readily. They don't need much prompting. There's a little advertising to convince you to buy one brand above another, but certainly it takes no advertising at all to sell food as such. And you can go on down the line to any commodity. The commodities that give most immediate satisfaction are the easiest sold. Now, so it is with all phases of life. One of the problems of selling religion, and I use that term with quotation marks around it, because in a sense, it is sold, or it has to be presented in a manner in which somebody will listen. Because very few of us, we recognize, will pick up a Bible and search it out. But it has to be made very appealing, and there has to be some work done on somebody's part to get another person to accept religion. Why? Well, principally because the benefits are considered to be long range. If you go to church on Sunday morning, you usually don't get any immediate satisfaction in the way that you get satisfaction from buying a nice meal in a nice restaurant, or buying a new suit of clothes, or buying an automobile. The satisfaction is not the same. It's different. It's harder to understand. It's harder to appreciate and harder to grasp. So the things that are of what we term a fleshly nature or of a carnal type are the easiest for us to buy. That's what makes life and the truth difficult. Because we find an easy attraction to the things about us which are of little value. We find it more difficult to comprehend the things that are of great value because the benefits are more far-reaching. They're not as apparent. That might be also said to be true of education. Education is a harder thing to sell to a person than the lack of education, because the benefits are far removed and it's difficult to attain it. At one time there was a test made to determine, in fact this has happened many times, but this particular test was made to determine what the difference was between the children that were constantly getting into trouble, which we term juvenile delinquents, and those who didn't get into as much trouble. It has been found that there are juvenile delinquents from all types of homes, from poor homes and from the homes of wealthy people, from homes of parents that abandon their children, so to speak, to their own devices, but also from the homes of parents that work hard to train their children. Some of those children don't turn out right also. But what is the difference? Is there any measurable difference? Well, somebody devised this idea, and there seemed to be a positive correlation. They called a number of children into the principal's office in a certain school. They offered each child as he came in, these were small children, they offered each child a candy bar, no strings attached, We'd like to give you a candy bar. As the child was picking up the candy bar, they said, wait a minute. If you will leave this candy bar today and come back tomorrow, we'll give you two candy bars. But you must leave this one today. And strangely enough, there was a very positive correlation between the children that constantly were getting into trouble, who were guilty of petty thefts and things like that, and the ones who took the candy bar immediately. The ones who were less inclined to be in trouble all the time went along with the idea. They left the candy bar in order that they could get two tomorrow. How many of us are willing to sacrifice something today in order that we can have something better tomorrow? Now, I don't think that's the whole point of religion, but it is a part of it. It is part of our relationship with God that we sacrifice something today in order to get something better tomorrow. There's much more to it, but at least that is one of the things that probably attracts many, if not most of us, to the truth initially. In the 18th chapter of Luke, starting with verse 9, we have I'll read it. And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. This is the parable. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Now here's the description of one man describing himself. He was happy with himself. He was a righteous man by a certain standard, namely his own. He was a fine fellow. Who would quarrel with a man with that type of reputation, assuming it's true, and I think you take that for granted. Who would quarrel with a man who lived that way? Wouldn't he be respected in any community? Wouldn't he be respected among us here? Very likely. Who would condemn a man like that? But we go on. And the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes unto heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Now here's another man. This man is a sinner, by his own admission. So he must have been. This man was of a group that was despised in those days. He was of a profession which was known to be one in which those engaged in that profession preyed upon other people. It was a despised profession in that day. But he recognized that he was a sinner, and apparently he was. Now notice next here. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For every one that exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. What was the difference in the two? Well, primarily one thing. One man recognized his needs, recognized what he was, and he prayed to God for God to help him. The other man didn't recognize that he had any needs at all. He was self-satisfied. By his own standard, he was righteous. But was that the type of righteousness which commended itself to God? Well, obviously not, because the point of the parable was that he did not go down to his house justified, but rather the one who admitted that he was a sinner. Now we wonder, we can all think this. It strikes, I think, home to every one of us. How many of us freely admit to ourselves, it doesn't make too much difference what we admit to others, but how many of us admit to ourselves that we need help and that we are, by nature sinners, and that we must turn to God and do turn to God for help from our difficulties. Because if we feel that only the other fellow needs help, we're like the rich man here, the Pharisee, rather. That's our problem. Many times we don't recognize our needs. We're willing to assume that we are all right today, forgetting that we may be miserable and poor and wretched, as the letter to one of the churches described one of the ecclesias. Miserable and poor and wretched. Now, we might ask ourselves this question. Do we spend more time thinking about the sins and the difficulties of our brethren than we do about our own sins? That's a good one to ask ourselves. Because apparently it's important. If it weren't important, I don't think this parable would have much place here. Because remember, this Pharisee was not thinking about his own sins. He was not thinking of his own needs, in this case. He was thinking of what a poor, miserable, wretched person this publican was, and how thankful he was that he wasn't like him. Do we do that? Perhaps we do sometimes. We have to answer these questions for ourselves only. Do we ever do this? Do we make comparisons of our sins with the sins of a brother or sister that we consider perhaps sins just a little bit more than we do? Do we ever say to ourselves, well, boy, I never did that. I never went out and got drunk. I don't smoke, if that's a sin. I don't go to dances, if that's a sin. I don't do this, I don't do that, but somebody else does. And then come up and say, well, I guess I'm in pretty good shape. Do we ever make such comparisons? If we do, we might consider this, that we're comparing ourselves under the worst possible circumstances. Because our standard, brethren, is not the life that our brother leads, whether it be good, bad, or indifferent. Our standard is the life of Christ. Now, if we want to make a comparison, we should compare the way we are living with the life that Christ led, because his life was approved of God. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. That's the comparison that we should be making. When we start saying, I don't do this, but brother so-and-so does that, or I don't do this, and sister so-and-so does that, we're on the wrong basis of comparison completely. It's a faulty basis of judgment. And we'll come up with some conclusions which are not valid. We are apt to come up just like the Pharisee here did, being thankful that we're not as other men. And then we're in trouble. In the 15th chapter of Luke that was read a few moments ago, we have three parables. There's the parable of the lost sheep, there's the parable of the piece of silver, and there's the parable of the prodigal son, as it's called. And each of these perhaps has basically the same teaching in them. But in the third one, there is a byproduct teaching which I don't think we should overlook. Because this, the byproduct teaching concerns the brother who was righteous, again by his own standard, and who stayed home. He didn't go out and squander his goods. He didn't go out and live life sinfully. He didn't partake of all the wiles of the world. He stayed home and did what was expected of him. Maybe many of us do that. We stay home. We don't carouse around. We do what is expected of us. We provide for our families. We do all of these things which any good citizen will do. But is that the standard which commends oneself to God? Because out of all this, that this elder brother did, there was still something wrong. He came up in the time of crisis with a frame of mind that was out of keeping with a Christian. Envy popped up. Envy. And he says here, he answering said to his father, "Lo, these many years do I serve thee, neither transgress I at any time thy commandment, and yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends." Never had a party for all this toil and service. Here he'd worked hard, he hadn't run away from home, he hadn't spent his father's goods, but nobody ever gave him a party like this, and he was a little envious. Now, here was a man who did not understand his own real needs. He was judging himself by his own standard. Brethren, I think if we have one great pitfall in life, perhaps that is one of the gravest, that we tend to judge ourselves by our own standards, and we get around to thinking, well, I'm a pretty good fellow. I do all right. I don't do this, and I don't do that, and I don't do something else, and I do this, and I do that, that I should, and so forth. But we just wonder if that's the proper basis upon which we should evaluate our service to God. Now, in James, the first chapter, the 23rd verse, we're admonished with this thought. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. Now, we read, all of us, in scriptures of loving our neighbor, and it even gives us an indication in scriptures of who our neighbor is, that it's anyone we come in contact with, anyone who needs our help or our service. We read these things, we study them, but do we really apply them? Do we really apply them? That's the problem that we are confronted with. We're hearers. We can at times. I'm not saying we're guilty of all of these things, but we can have a form of godliness. We can have a form of worship, but we can be missing the whole point of it, which is developing a character after that of our Lord Jesus Christ. In 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, this we hear almost every Sunday at the memorial service. Let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. We can find ourselves assembling around the memorial table, perhaps, thinking of what's wrong with the meeting, what's wrong with our brother, who perhaps shouldn't be here today because he's not the kind of person that should meet with us, or another ecclesia that we're out of fellowship with, and we can be all distraught about it, and being perhaps watching the door to see that the wrong person doesn't come in, and doing things like that. Now, we are not admonished to assemble each first day of the week and examine one another. That is not our admonition. We are admonished to meet each first day of the week and examine ourselves. That's the basis upon which we meet around the memorial table. Nothing else is scriptural. Now, sometimes we can be very smug in our abstentions. Take, for example, a brother who works for wages. may spend a lot of his time talking about the evils of the man in business. Oh, I wouldn't be in business. Businessmen are all crooks. He worries about it. He's not in business, so it's no great problem for him, but he worries about it. All businessmen are crooks. Now, the brother in business doesn't worry about that so much, but he may worry about labor unions, lest any brother belong to a labor union. Terrible. You can't do that. It's the worst thing in the world. He worries about it. Never thinks of anything else pertaining to the man in business, but he worries about the other fellow. Take the elder who is very, it's very easy for him to condemn the evils of dancing and going to parties. He's 77 years old. He hasn't been to a party since he was 25. But he worries about it. Shouldn't do that. The poor people, a lot of us perhaps fall into this category, we talk about the evils of being wealthy. Boy, just these wealthy people, they're all crooks. We worry about it, maybe. The rich man, he's not concerned with that, but he thinks it's just terrible if a poor man who's starving steals a loaf of bread. Throw him in jail. Now, these are things that somewhere along the line, maybe one of them touches us some way. We wonder if we're as ready to condemn a sin which we are apt to commit ourselves as we are to condemn a sin that somebody else is likely to commit and not ourselves. Which one do we judge the most severely? A sin which we're apt to commit, or the sin which somebody else is apt to commit but we wouldn't commit? Should there be any difference? No. All sin is equally bad in the eyes of God. There's no big sin and little sin in that sense. Just because one touches us and another doesn't, let's not be jumping on the and condemning more severely, I didn't say not to condemn it, but more severely, the individual who's apt to commit a sin that we are not apt to commit. Now, we've all heard situations like that. Happens to all of us. Now, we wonder this. Is it possible that many sins are not committed by each of us, largely because we've never had the opportunity? Think about it a little bit. Maybe nobody in here gambles. But who's had an opportunity to gamble? I'm not saying that that's one thing we would fall victim to, but just as an example. It's very easy to condemn a sin which does not come close to us, therefore offers us no temptation. But we wonder if we would hold up as well if we were put to the test as we're holding up against it when it's 1,000 miles removed. A problem for all of us to think about. Now, why bring all these points up, you may wonder? Well, for this reason. It seems to me that one of the things that we try to develop in our character is compassion for the other fellow, compassion for our brother or sister. Now, if we can feel our own inadequacies and recognize them, isn't it logical that we're going to have more compassion for our brother and sister? The publican who asked God to have mercy upon him because he was a sinner, isn't it more reasonable that he would have more compassion toward another sinner than the Pharisee who could not see any sin in himself? Now, if we can examine ourselves, and if we can recognize our own needs, seems to me that then and only then can we have real compassion toward our brother or sister when he is slipping. Christ was tempted with all the temptations that we can be confronted with. Now, after that, and after emerging triumphant over them, he was in a position to have compassion on all the people that he saw. Pardon me, even to those who crucified him. Forgive them, for they know not what they do. Compassion for them. In John, the 8th chapter, we have the incident in which the woman was taken in adultery and brought to Christ. The purpose of bringing her there was to trap him, get him into trouble, to see if he would go against the law of Moses, which they felt he was flirting with danger, that he was breaking the law of Moses. He knew what they were trying to do. They were trying to trap him with the letter of the law. So they bring this woman. Obviously, she's a sinner. There's no question about it. That doesn't enter into it, the point of it here exactly. But they bring her there, and she's put down in front of him for the sole purpose of getting him to commit himself. What are you going to do about this? You going to condemn her? You should. Stone her? Yes. According to the law, you'd stone a person in that circumstance. But he had compassion. And compassion came before the letter of the law. Compassion was to try to get her to refrain from doing the things that she had been doing. In other words, to cease from sinning. Now that's the purpose of any compassion which we have. It's not to condemn, but to induce the person to refrain from doing what he has been doing. And only after that has been extended to the utmost, 70 times 7, are you in a position to even consider condemning an individual. After the utmost in compassion has been extended. Because we are all sinners. We're all in the same boat. We all need this compassion. Suppose that I do something that is a terrible thing. I need help then, not condemnation. I need help, not condemnation. So the point is here. Now, he wanted to teach her a lesson. He wanted her to cease from doing the thing that she was being condemned for. That was one purpose. Also, to try to arouse a little compassion on the part of those who wanted her condemned. So, he writes something on the ground, and we aren't told exactly what it is. But he makes this statement, "He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her." Now, maybe there was nobody there who was actually guilty of the deed involved. But according to Christ's principles, harboring the desire to commit a sin is tantamount to committing it. So maybe he wrote something on the ground that implied something along that line. We don't know. But coupled with the statement that he made, nobody was willing to cast the first stone and say, "Yes, I'm without sin, I'll do it." They all silently slipped away. Compassion. Now, can't you imagine that there would be no better way of teaching this woman a lesson than an experience like this? Showing the real compassion of Jesus poured out. I mean, it's a stirring thing to consider, the wisdom of Christ and his compassion toward his brethren. Or take in the 5th chapter of John the incident of the impotent man that lay by the pool of Bethesda. It doesn't say how long he lay there, but it does say that he was infirm for, I think, 30 years. Had an ailment. He was bedridden for about 30 years, paralysis or something, I don't know just what it was. But According to tradition, and this has been inserted, I think, in this fourth verse about the moving of the waters, it's thought, I believe, that the insertion was a description of the legend that or tradition that went that did exist about this particular pool, that whoever get into the pool first after some kind of a movement of the water would be healed. But this fellow was bedridden, and he couldn't move quickly enough to be the first one in. Now, Jesus healed him, and he was told to take up his bed and walk, and Jesus was condemned, along with the individual, because it occurred on the Sabbath day. Because you don't pick up a bed and carry it on the Sabbath day. It's against the law. The letter of the law, that is. Now, if you're moving beds to set up a dormitory, that's one thing. But if you've been infirm for 30 years and were told by somebody who was having compassion unto you to pick up your bed and you could walk now, there's quite a difference, isn't there? Tremendous difference. One would be breaking the law, the other would not. But technically, maybe there was at least a perceived infraction of this law. But the whole point of the incident was missed. And those who were sticklers for the letter were ready to condemn Jesus and the man for doing this on the Sabbath day. Now, one of the points here is the fact that for 30 years, the Jews that were willing to condemn had never made any attempt to help this poor man. And they were ready to condemn the first one who came along and did something for him. It's remarkable how low the human mind can sink at times. Under the cloak of legality. Now, it's our job to develop the same type of compassion that Jesus developed and demonstrated. That's one of our jobs as a Christian. We're to grow spiritually. We are to have a better character now than we had 5 years or 10 years or 20 or 30 years ago. We're to grow constantly. And growth is, to a great measure, growth in our compassion, our love for God and for our fellow human beings, and to a little bit greater extent, perhaps, our brethren. But it's not to be limited. You don't draw a line, and I love everybody up to this point, and beyond that, I don't. But the human mind is such that it tends to do that. I love everybody who agrees with me. If you don't agree with me, we'll just won't love you for a while. That's the way the human mind operates, but it's not the way that God intended it. In the 10th chapter of Romans, one of the needs that we should recognize in ourselves is demonstrated in the first couple of verses. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. For I bear them record that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. Brethren, we can fall into the same condition of having our own righteousness without submitting to the righteousness of God. It's perhaps one of the gravest errors that I believe we can fall into today. Maybe it's one of the gravest problems that we as brethren of Christ have to face. Establishing our own righteousness, our own standards, and then forgetting that it does not agree with the righteousness of God. And then in the 12th chapter, some admonitions are given to us I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For I say, through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. Now, faith builds these qualities in us. Faith is a starting point for love. You cannot have love unless it's coupled with faith. Love in the sense in which the scriptures use it. You cannot love God unless you first have faith in God. Faith is a foundation. But love is the end product of faith. Love for God, which includes love for the brethren, love for our fellow man. Now these things have to be built on the principles and the standards which Christ gave to us. They cannot be by our own standards. In the latter part of the chapter, we're admonished to recompense no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink, for in so doing thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good.